cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm present. Hello, Whit. We meet once again.
We do. You've got a squeaky chair.
As long as I don't have a squeaky voice, it's fine.
Well, we might get there by the end of this. So, no guest in studio today.
It's our first solo show since January, I think.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I think we did our first sort of solo last year around this time. We called it Mayhem, so now we've got to come up with another clever name for the show.
Mayhem, back with a vengeance.
It's weak. It's something Hollywood would typically do, so we might just run with it.
Absolutely. So this show is a bit different, though. We're not just going to shoot the shit out of nowhere. So we put out a post in our Facebook group asking people to post some questions, and then we decided to answer them on air. And we got a very nice mix of questions. Somehow people are really interested in what do you think about healthcare for some reason. I can't think of anything more boring than healthcare.
You're going to die one day, Ramon.
No, I know
that. If you're not interested in your healthcare, it's going to be horrible.
Okay. So if you're interested for our next solo show, join our group on Facebook. Just look for Renegade Report Group and join. And we will approve or decline. For some reason, a hell of a lot of like Thai-looking names want to join our group.
It's those lady boys, you know.
But it's weird.
Like, well, Facebook is just going according to your Google search. So I'm just saying.
Nonsense. What?
Right, should we get on with it?
Utter crap. All right, so should we actually say who asked the question? We didn't expressly ask.
No, yeah, let's go for it. I don't think anyone wants anonymity. I think it's fine.
Okay, we'll just use first names then.
Yeah, cool.
Right, so Russell asks, what are our respective journeys to classical liberalism in our respective variations thereof?
And maybe you should start, because you're the one with the whole bunch of caveats here. Yeah, well, you recently abandoned libertarianism.
But I never was libertarian.
All right,
in a classical sense.
So start.
Well, I mean, firstly, I went to Wits. If you want to become a conservative, just go to Wits.
I can concur, actually, with that. It will either make you completely socialist or completely conservative.
Right. And, I mean, I was doing law, and the lecturer was pontificating that the ANC government has built more houses than any other government in the history of the world. And he was saying this was a good thing. And then when I asked him, but why should the government build houses? He was like flabbergasted. It's like I committed a mortal sin. and that coincided with reading Milton Friedman and actually just YouTube videos of Thomas Sowell and Milton Friedman. So before I would be called, I think, like a classic conservative Republican without the religion. Like anti-gay marriage for some reason. I don't know why. When I was a teenager, I thought, no, gays were like a bit wrong.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I actually didn't have an issue with gay people, but I probably would have been against gay marriage as a teenager. Yeah,
same here. And I don't know why. So I looked at Milton Friedman. I read about economics first.
The patriarchy that did that to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I read about economics first, then Milton Friedman, then von Mises. And then at Wits, thankfully, we learned about someone called Robert Nozick. He wrote State, Anarchy, Utopia, or some sort of book about that. And once I read that, there you go. I was like, okay, yeah, freedom's cool for everyone. And I don't give a shit who you are and what you decide to do. As long as you don't punch me in the face, we're all good.
Yeah, all right. So I don't have as long a history, I suppose. I think I get to this point through a lot of experiences that I've had through my life, mostly late teenage years through my 20s. Also, went to Wits, was involved quite heavily in student politics. So I got to see a lot of the side of unions, essentially, because that's what student politics have become and the damage that they cause. And a lot of these thoughts were in my head, and I had formulated my opinions on things or my views on things. Didn't really know how I'd put them in a box. as much as you can put classical liberalism in a box. I think that's one of the issues with the entire spectrum of the right: conservatism, classical liberalism, libertarianism, even anarchism. Is that it's very difficult to box these things, because one classical liberal or libertarian is different to what another one will tell you they think it means. And I have to be honest, this show has been one of the sort of foundational parts of really cementing my views and what I truly believe. I think a lot of the things were there already. But once we started chatting on the show, you can go back to some of the early episodes and shows we did with people like Gwen and Gwenya, Martin van Staden, and Sihle and Gobesi. And I know he gets a lot of credit and he deserves it. Listening to those people and listening to the views, and as we've gone through and on, and listening to people whose views I don't always agree with. Steve Hoffmeyer, some of his stuff I didn't agree with, some of it I did. It's just those are the things that have really sort of formulated it together. And then myself also, you know, getting exposed to some of the, I suppose, philosophers and economists, the great ones of the past sort of 100-150 years, and a lot of exposure to the guys who are around now, the guys who are doing shows, Dave Rubin, for example, Ben Shapiro. I think in the last year, a lot of those people have had quite a big influence on my thinking.
Yeah, and let's not forget that we started as a reaction, in a way, to the left. But now, not anymore. We're still developing our own ideology, in a way, independently from being a reaction.
Yeah, look, I think you have to be open to, and we've always said this, and I think anyone healthy would say this, you have to be open to changing your ideas and your views. It is about an ideology. I don't buy this whole, oh, having an ideology is bad. You've got to have some sort of way you view the world. You've got to have a lens. The lens is classical liberalism, but for example, I've been swayed quite a bit on my drug stance. But not completely.
Yeah.
And one classical liberal would argue with me and tell me, "Well, you're not really classical liberal because you know you view it in the way you still do." And someone else would go, "Well, no, I don't agree with you, and therefore maybe say, fine, you're classical liberal, but you're nowhere near conservative."
Right. But at least they don't call you a Nazi for having a different opinion on drugs.
Sure. So, I mean, the left is who calls people Nazis because they like to identify with their own, because as we've said before, the Nazis were on the left, which was another question that came up on the group, is what is the left and what is the right?
Well, today it seems like the right is it's weird, it's changed. It's now actually, in America, at least, the right seems to be in favor of big government, in a nationalistic sense. Mm. Like for me, Obama was a great right wing president in that regard, because he was like big statism, healthcare for Americans. You know, like Marine Le Pen in France too. She's right wing, but it's but huge social welfare for citizens, you know, building immigration controls and things like that. So the right has morphed a little bit to more nationalistic. The left today is, I think, everyone who wants more government control of the economy, though the right does like some of that too. So I don't know. I mean, I sit in the extreme center of both.
I think
I just don't like the state at all. And I prefer human innovation and human freedom rather than anything the state does. So,
yeah, if you're asking the question about the right and the left, it's a complex question. If you do a Google search, right versus left, and just click on images, you'll see there's identical images which then place various groups, depending on the image, who's posted it on either side. So, for example, I call Nazis leftists.
Right.
And if you go on the web, you'll find images that show you that and articles that say that. And you'll find articles that say, no, they're far on the far right. I think it can be difficult to say what's left and what's right. There is definitely some confusion as you're mentioning, with regards to, for example, nationalism has popped up on the right, although I don't think that that's in the true sense of it, is part of its original roots.
Well, but I don't think there's an essential element of right-wing and left-wing anymore. So I don't think there ever was.
Yeah.
I think there were principles on both sides, but now they're melded. And as soon as you go to the extremes of both, the horseshoe effect takes place.
Yeah, so the horseshoe is what's important.
So so if you look at the horseshoe at the two ends, we are like, personally, I am right in the middle of the horseshoe itself, away from the ends.
What do they call you? A fringe lunatic, I think, is that part of the horseshoe, actually, is what they call the anarchists. But the horseshoe is important because it shows you where, and I don't really think you do fit into the horseshoe. You might on anarchy, but not on other views. But it's really where the far right and the far left meet. And if you look at something like the US, where you find Antifa and the sort of guys on the far religious right, sort of loonies, there really isn't much difference. Both want to control, complete control over their societies, and very little freedom, actually.
Yeah. So we're not left or right. We just want maximum freedom, less government intervention, ideally none or no government at all, for me personally. And we want evidence based on scientific categories, because the physical world exists.
I would say, if you've got to describe left and right, in my opinion, more right-wing views tend towards freedom, individual freedoms, whereas left-wing views tend towards collective freedoms, which are not freedoms because they collectivize. Right. That brings us to a question I think you got on WhatsApp, which was something about how freedom and government sort of mix.
Well, what is the dissonance between equality and liberty? Is one at the expense of another? And which ideology is preferable?
And? Thoughts?
Equality, man. It's the most dangerous concept in political theory that I've ever seen. Because... It's not equality of opportunity, it's equity. So outcome must be the same for everyone, irrespective of the inputs at the beginning. So I want to live in an unequal society, but the inequality must be based on individual freedoms and choices and networks rather than state intervention, of course.
Yeah, I've said multiple times on the show how I don't buy into equality at all. The equality of opportunity, yes, but there's a problem there as well. You're never going to get perfect equality of opportunity.
Yeah.
There has to be some reality involved. What did you want to be when you were a kid? If you wanted to be a doctor or a fireman or whatever it is, those things are, you should have equal opportunity to access those things. All six-year-olds should be able to, in theory, if they work towards it, get there. But the reality is there are some things you're never going to be able to get equal opportunity to. As a South African, you don't have equal opportunity to become an astronaut because, well, America's probably sent 60 men and women into space, and, I don't know, probably a handful of them have been non-Americans, for example.
And we won't be basketball players in the NBA.
Yeah.
I mean, people are not worried about equality like in sports for some reason. But they're worried about equality in demographics in like the corporate world or something to that effect. It's like it's always equality in economic terms, not in social terms.
Well, that was an interesting point, because someone asked a question about what would we change in the Constitution.
Ooh, everything.
And before you get to everything, I was giving it some thought around one of the things I would change, certainly in the South African Constitution, would be I would remove any protections for majorities. So BEE, for example, affirmative action would be out at minimum with a sunset clause. It's not something I would leave in there forevermore as it currently is.
Yeah.
And I suppose the argument there would be about economic equality, because obviously, there's a disadvantaged population, of which the majority of whom are black individuals. And I was just thinking that that equality is brought around by tax, because that's got nothing to do with race. If you're successful, you get taxed more. And if you're not as successful, you get taxed less.
Sure.
Very simple. So you don't need a constitutional amendment to make sure that, you know, the rich essentially pay their fair share and the poor get their, get a sort of step up by not being taxed at 40%. So that's one thing, certainly, and that's just one reason, but and one approach. But that's definitely something I would change. We've got a constitution that you have to understand currently protects the majority. And at some point, that's going to become wrong, despite our past. So in 100 or 200 years' time, if, for example, there are 100,000 white people left and 100 million black people in the country, and it's been 200 years, then why are you still protecting the majority? Constitution should look to protect minorities.
Yeah, well, it does do that. It is based on individual rights, the Constitution, but it hasn't just
been... But that clause, for example.
Yeah, but it hasn't been tested in court. Most of it hasn't been tested. I would remove all socioeconomic rights, health, housing, water, things like that. I'll let the market...
All of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll let the market... Because it's not a right if it's contingent on a budget from the state.
Or a person to provide it.
So there was a famous case as the Minister of Housing versus Grootboom, right? Who said, the Constitution said, I have a right to a house. I don't have one, so give me a house. And it went all the way to the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court said, you have the right to a house, but there's no money. So you have the right to access to housing. Now, it's not a right if it's contingent on something. It's not an inalienable right. It's not like the right to free speech or the right to vote or things like that. So I would remove all socioeconomic rights. I would also remove a lot of the duties of the federal system. I'll give a lot more autonomy to provinces. There's a lot to change.
That said, though, would you change the provinces? Because the autonomy to provinces, you know, it kind of implies that the group in the provinces has some sort of homogeneity. They want the people in an area want a certain. They want to direct themselves in a certain way.
It's not about that. It's just about the devolution of power. So, I mean, if you vote for someone who lives within 100-kilometer radius, or whatever the case might be. So, in Gauteng, if we vote for the premier of Gauteng, we know where his office is because it's within, what, how big is Gauteng? It's within like 100 kilometers of where you
probably
are. Right.
Sure.
So you know exactly who to go to and you know who controls where the budget goes to. If the budget's only used within Gauteng,
yeah,
there's far more transparency and accountability.
Yeah.
That's very similar. I mean, if I could have the Swiss system. Canton system, I would have it tomorrow.
Yeah, all right. So remove that power. I'm okay with that. What about also... I'm not sure if this is more legislative than constitutional, but in terms of how we vote. So instead of voting sure. for a party and the party decides who all their people are, we vote for individuals. You know, I would like to be able to vote for a president.
If it's based on constituencies, you vote for your local MP.
Yep.
And the MP goes to parliament and represents your interests. Like in Britain, like in Switzerland.
Yeah, and I would very much, you know, I don't buy the 5,000 people meet in a tent at a undisclosed or disclosed location every 5 years and decide who our next president is. That is the ANC system.
Yeah. Well, that's proportional representation.
Yeah, and it's I just don't like it. I think, and we would have a very different scenario. The truth be told is that 5 years, well, what is it, 3 years ago now, 4 years ago now, we wouldn't have ended up with Jacob Zuma. You know, it was him against Galema Motlanthe, I think, and we almost certainly would have Galema Motlanthe as our president. Just on to continue on this theme of the Constitution, we've said it before, but the Equality Court and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, that's not technically part of the Constitution. But that was legislation.
It's directed, though, from the Constitution. So it's directed that there would be some sort of
misdirected.
there'd be a process or a body that would sort of deal with that type of stuff.
Yeah.
I would take away anything that takes away that looks to impede freedom in any sense with regards to expression, speech, etc. So I think those are
if. if I don't know, Black First Land First keeps holding up signs in the middle of Sandton City about kill the whites, would you?
Yeah,
be okay with that.
I think we have to be consistent here. So last year, when Penny Sparrow happened and all the other stuff around it, and people were saying nasty stuff on Facebook, frankly, people at Wits were walking around already with kill whites or fuck the whites. That was the t-shirt that they were walking around with. The reality is that did I like the t-shirts? No. Did I like the people's racist posts on Facebook? No. But we have to be consistent. I have to be consistent and say, well, I defended those people's right to say those things and to express themselves in saying those things. And I defend Black First Land First's right to do it today.
Right.
And I think I would be hypocritical if I didn't. It is becoming a bit more complicated because now we really are in South Africa getting to the baying mob example. So we're getting closer to the point where it's you're saying stuff, but it's not like there's no reasonable expectation that this will result in some sort of physical action, including violence.
Yeah.
And so it's starting to become a bit more complex. And we had this discussion with Mark,
Mark and Rian last week.
It's becoming a bit more complex. Yeah. So Colony as an example, very difficult to say there. Should in an environment people are literally burning houses, should someone be able to stand up and go, we should burn all the whites' houses? Well, probably not, because they are literally doing it. People are doing it.
But I still think it's a question of speech, but it's about the veracity of the response to that speech, which is a problem. Because as you saw with Rian, when he just said what he saw, people said, oh, the way he uses words is problematic. And what he really meant was X, Y, and Z. And no, Rian said, no, the Bangladeshi stores were looted and burnt. That's what happened. It was done on not the order, so to speak, but there was talk that the EFF are behind it. And the Premier of the Northwest had this horrible eulogy that was full of racial scapegoating and things like that. That's what happened. That's a matter of fact. And that is a response to the situation. But then Rian is shut down by Sisonke et al.
Yeah.
So I'm not too worried about the Northwest Premier saying his thing, but if I respond, my claim should be just as strong as his claim to speech. But the problem is, if I say something in return, oh, you white fragile, white anxiety, etc. So no one actually really listens to what I say. They just look at my character and then just paint me in this way.
Yeah.
That's the big problem for me.
What do you think about the problem of, let's say speech is fine, there's nothing wrong with speech, but the issue is that at some point, if in a society like ours, certainly, there has to be a way to protect those who would go beyond that. So the police, as an example, should be there to protect citizens from those who would take a speech and then use that speech as motivation to go and burn down someone's house or attack them or loot their shop or do whatever. And we don't have a really effective police service. So we're trying to kind of say, well, should speech kind of be stopped because it's causing these bad things, or should we rather just try focus on having police that actually are efficient in this process? I know you're not a big fan of the police.
No. Well, this may surprise you, but I can fully see the justification for banning speech if it causes division. In the way that Singapore does it. So in Singapore, you're allowed to be any religion you want. You just don't proselytize it in public. You don't put it on Facebook. You don't say, oh, Muslims are terrorists, etc. Because then you'll get fined. Because it creates unnecessary division in the society. But it's a small city state, and all they're worried about is making money. And if you talk about these sort of things, you divert attention away. I look at that. It's illiberal, but I understand why it's happening. And I don't approve, but I see why. I don't approve, but I can see why people would approve of that.
Yeah, the issue there comes in is who's defining what's divisive.
No, it's the state.
Once again, you know, somewhere like Singapore, you have, once again, a relatively homogenous environment or group of people. Singaporeans, as far as I know, I'm sure there are different cultures and whatever there, but diversity is our strength. I don't think it'd be as diverse as South Africa, for example, where, you know, what one group might find crosses a boundary is
we've got 12 tribes living in this country. Okay, 13, 13 if you argue that white English Europeans are another tribe.
Yeah, I mean, they're
not going to agree on everything.
Yeah,
at all.
I would rather, yeah, I'm not sure I buy the Singapore thing. The biggest problem with Singapore is it's a bit of an issue when you try to argue these things, because it's one of those countries where some of the stuff works and the country works really well. And so dictatorship, for example, they have a benevolent dictatorship. So it kind of is the one example of dictatorship works. Put it that way.
Sure.
Benevolent dictatorship works. So provided you're not really killing people, although they do jail people and they do harshly punish people.
But people are aware of what the crime is.
Yeah.
They don't just create crimes on the whim.
They don't fake it.
If you have drugs, you'll be imprisoned. That's been the law for 50 years.
And they're not planting drugs on people to, like, add political dissidents to put them in prison and stuff like that. It's kind of the only place it's really worked. Can you think of other examples?
South Korea. South Korea had a dictator for about 30 years. Park, I think, was his name.
But I think they've done better since they haven't, since they've had a democratic system.
True. But as Wessel van Rensburg said on this podcast, has there been like a liberated country that has worked very well under liberal principles out of the starting gates? I don't know. There's always been an evolution of this authoritarianism and then like liberal values and then full on liberty, and then it's worked well. But the United States.
Well, then it's worked well, and I would argue we're in the middle of the experiment. So I'm not sure if then it's eaten itself.
Yeah. I mean, but you need authoritarianism that is looking to make the country wealthier. Here we just got authoritarianism that is looking to make, well, for self-enrichment only.
I mean, let's run with your idea in South Africa. Let's say we go and say anything that's divisive is, you're not allowed to say.
Yeah, you
get 3 months in jail and a 10,000 rand fine.
Sure.
Okay. And that would include from either side. So you CBS can no longer say white people have privilege.
Yes.
Okay. And I don't know, Steve can no longer say black people are committing genocide.
Yes.
And
we can't say feminism is cancer. Oof, I don't know.
Yeah, we can't say feminism is cancer. All these kinds of things. So anything, so all of those things kind of ruins discussion, actually. I mean, what would discuss? Well, the weather is nice today, isn't it, Ramon?
But it's also a question of enforcement as well, of course.
Yeah. It would obviously apply to people with a platform, I imagine. It wouldn't apply to people in their homes, because you'd never be able to really track that. So it would mostly be public platforms, politicians, media people, etc., who couldn't say those things anymore. Do you think we'd be in a better place?
In this country, no.
Yeah, I don't think
so. We're not homogenous by any means. We're not. I think it's actually very important that we have as much free speech as possible, just to get all that shit out in the public, and then we can fight it.
Yeah. Well, this podcast wouldn't have been possible if that kind of ruling was around.
No, it wouldn't work here. In Singapore, it works. You've got a million people within like 30 square kilometers. Like, it's not difficult to control that.
All right. What else have we got on the bill?
Right. So people are very interested in healthcare.
Okay, shoot some stuff at me. I haven't prepared, so I'll do my best.
We can see that. So what is your future prognosis for the medical healthcare industry in this country? And I assume this would invoke the NHI.
Yeah.
And Aaron Motsoaledi, who thinks private medical aids are like devil. Okay.
So the first thing to say is that the government has been on a crusade against private healthcare for a number of years now. And that's been facilitated through a number of means. One is that they've gone to the Competition Commission to try and nail the hospitals for collusion, which may or may not be going on. They've also, that's from the competition side, they've also tried to regulate very heavily to try and make life a lot more difficult for private providers. Hasn't really actually stunted private providers that are already established. It's stunted small ones. As an example, I tried to help a nurse not too long ago. She was a midwife. She wanted to open up a small clinic on the outskirts of a township where she would help deliver babies. This would cost patients what they could afford, essentially. It would be probably a profitable business based on the outlook. And it was unable to be done because the building she had found, the corridors were 1.1 meters and they by law needed to be 1.4 meters or something stupid like that. And so it would have involved a whole bunch of construction, which wasn't affordable. So they've done a whole bunch of those things. And then obviously there's the NHI. What happens to South African healthcare depends very much on the NHI ultimately. If it goes ahead, which is unlikely, and the reason it's unlikely is because they can't fund it. You're on. They can't fund the NHI. There's been a whole bunch of proposals. Essentially, it's going to be your tax. They're going to have to take it out of your tax, and it's around 10%. If you're at the upper end of the tax bracket and you're paying around 40% tax, you're going to pay 50% tax. If that happens, for a number of reasons, healthcare in this country will collapse. And
so will the middle class.
Yeah.
If you want to destroy the middle class, take healthcare away.
Yeah.
They will go elsewhere.
So there's a bunch of economists who've looked at this. I don't want to misquote him, but Chris Hart's one of them. And when it first happened, I went to a lot of the meetings and gave my opinion. One of the things that happens then is 10% of your salary goes to paying for a government medical aid, which allows you to go to government healthcare. And what that means is that the majority of medical aid payers are on the lower levels of medical aid. So most people are not on a Discovery executive plan. They're on one of the lower plans. And so if you tax them an extra 1,000 to 2,000 rand a month, they can no longer afford to be on the Discovery or Fed Health or whatever you're on. So then what happens is medical aid becomes a niche market. But now if your executive plan was costing you R5,000, it now costs you R20,000. It's just basic economics. I'm sucking numbers, obviously, but that's essentially what's going to happen. So the rich will stay on medical aids. The middle class won't be able to afford it anymore, the guys who are on the middle plans, and they'll drop off too. And then what happens is on the other side is the doctors are going to leave in droves. So the entire system, in my opinion, exists because Erin Motsoaledi came into government with a health department which was not in a good space. And I believe he probably sat down at some point and said, what do I need to fix healthcare? And the answer to that was, well, you probably need 500 hospitals and 10,000 specialists. And he said, how much will they cost me? And they said, look, it'll take about 25 years and it'll probably cost you X number of trillion rand. And instead of doing that, he said, all right, where can I get 500 hospitals and 10,000 specialists? And so the answer is very simple. If you somehow hijack the private industry and make it the public industry, then there you go. There's your hospitals and there's your specialists. And that's what they intend to do. The reason why doctors will leave is because government will now say they will take away the free market. So they will now say, we will pay you 3,000 rand as a surgeon to do an appendix. Some surgeons will go, okay, no problem. Generally, those will be the guys who in a free market do not necessarily have tons of patients coming to them. And the guys who are charging 10 will go, screw you, I'm out of here. You'll probably get a flight. The other problem we have, which is one of the reasons why public healthcare is a mess, is if I'm in public healthcare and I am, let's use a surgeon as an easy example. If I have 5 complications for every 10 surgeries I do, that would make me quite a bad surgeon. And my colleague has 1 complication for every 10 he does that make him good, not amazing. Him and I will earn the same amount of money at the end of the year. Him and I, well, there are no bonuses, but if there were, we would get the same bonus. And no one would even notice these differences in complication rates. And ultimately, when you do that, you're just asking for mediocrity. And so if the NHI answer the bottom line answer to the question, if the NHI comes in, we're a bit screwed in terms of healthcare. Get to know a doctor, make sure they've got a nice dining room table that you can lie on. And if it doesn't come in, which it won't, based on the fact that the fiscus is currently screwed, we can't afford it. And if the DA comes into power at any point, it also probably won't, certainly not in that format. Then we'll be okay and we will remain a very good healthcare country. Just to say something, if you are able to go to private healthcare in this country, we're rated as one of the top 10 countries for healthcare in the world. That's in the private industry. In fact, one scale has us fourth in the world. You have some of the Nordic countries and then us. So we beat Australia, Canada, the US, the UK, all those countries.
In Canada, it's better to be a dog than a human because the veterinary services are not
socialized,
regulated at all.
Yeah.
And your dog can get a surgery today, whereas you have to wait like 4 months.
Yeah, you wait for your surgery. So that's on that. Is there anything else on healthcare? Have I covered
it? Not really. I just wanted to know, Nicholas asks, do you think the government should be in healthcare in any way?
That's an interesting question.
Try and keep it.
Yeah, I'll keep it short because it's healthcare and I'm taking the whole podcast. I think that there's a small, but this is my general view on government. So I think there's a small role for government in the people who absolutely cannot afford it. And I would probably run that on a voucher system the same way as I would run schools. But I would not allow the government to provide that healthcare. Indeed. I would still have private industry providing the healthcare.
So for those who don't know a voucher system, you just give a card or a debit card to someone in need. You put on 50,000 rand for the year and they can only use that at a healthcare facility of sorts. And they use the money on the card for their healthcare needs. I think that will work very, very well.
Yeah.
So all the basics are covered. Right, so Sebastian has a quote by Oscar Wilde, which I think is quite great. He said, "The UK would have peace if only the Irish would learn how to listen and the English would learn how to talk. How applicable is this for black and white in SA? Personally, I think there isn't enough dialogue at all in this country. I think a lot of people lead completely separate lives. I have nothing in common with many black compatriots. They have nothing in common with me. I don't watch soccer. They love soccer. I don't use public transport.
In fairness, you don't have much in common with your white compatriots who watch soccer either.
Right, right. but in terms of lifestyle, in terms of transport, in terms of income, in terms of just networking, we share very little whatsoever. So I think dialogue is extremely, extremely valuable. But unfortunately, the ordinary person wants dialogue. The people controlling the way dialogue is used don't want dialogue. They want to shut people down for views and criminalize views. So I think a lot more dialogue is required, but in a way that permeates throughout the society, but I don't know how it's going to be done.
So I'm not convinced on the dialogue, but it's something that politicians like to rest on. I think Sindile made fair points in terms of integration. So
yes.
I've basically my entire working life has been spent amongst a, for want of a better word, diverse group of South Africans, and largely with a black population.
Yeah, same here.
I've spent, in fact, most of my working life in Soweto, actually, which I love. I very much enjoy working there.
Look at you gentrifying Soweto.
but I think that part of that sort of, instead of just, you skip the dialogue, if you can just basically bring people together because they have similar interests or similar goals, or are just getting along with their lives and they just happen to cross paths. And so it doesn't become a race thing at all. It's not about black and white. So,
sure.
If we we go to a braai and they just, wouldn't it be great if, and I think most people do this, I certainly do, but it should be that you go to a braai and there just happen to be people there, not you go to a braai and you go, oh, there's a black dude, or, oh, there's a white dude. The ideal sort of situation. And I suppose that's better than dialogue to me.
Well, I mean, dialogue in a sense, not like having a formal, national discussion, but just being able to just talk to each other, generally speaking.
Yeah. Look, I mean, one of the issues in terms of dialogue we have is, and in terms of that quote that you read out, is currently we have a group being told to shut up. One side is being told literally in those words, shut up or keep quiet.
Yes.
And the other side is
he's saying, no, and the other side is, no, be quiet. We will speak on your behalf.
Yes.
Because we know better than you.
Yeah. So actually there's a sort of hypocritical group in the middle. I think it's a work in progress.
Yeah. And I think the more, as Cindy said a few weeks ago, if there's more upwardly mobile black people, then you'll see that it is a class problem, not a race problem. Mm. I have many compatriots who are in the same middle class as I am, and we get along fine. We worry about the price of bread at Woolies or whatever the fuck it is. And that's it. So now people are very, very interested in why I don't consider myself a libertarian anymore.
We didn't get through this in the beginning. So did you ever consider yourself a libertarian?
I self-identified as one, personally.
That's in an Apache helicopter.
For a while. I'm still have a lot of empathy for the libertarian position. I do think more freedom is better than less freedom. But I think if you only look at the world in terms of freedom and oppression and in economic terms, I don't think it's helpful. Very good friends who are socialists say, I mean, is the profit motive the best way to run an education system, as an example? And that floored me. I'm like, yeah, surely, yes. And you think about it more, maybe it isn't the best way to run education. For libertarian, they'll be fine, because it's private enterprise competing, etc. Is it the best way to run education? I have my doubts.
So what if, is it because, so in that example, is it because profit outcome and education outcome are separate?
Well, if profit is your motive,
yeah, then you don't really care what your product is.
No, you do care what your product is, but how do we know the product is actually the optimal way to teach someone something?
Yeah, well, but let's take a school. Yeah, that's the profit-driven school, private school.
Yeah.
I think certainly at the upper echelons of these schools, they will very much look at what they're putting out. They tell you how many distinctions their kids got and all the rest of it. But let's take a lower to middle end version of
Model
that.
Model C school or whatever.
Private one. Sure. Yeah, that kind of level. The issue being is if they've turned over good profit at the end of the year, according to whoever owns them, they've done well. If the shareholders are happy, but if the kids coming out aren't particularly solid in terms of their ability or knowledge, that's where the issue comes in.
I mean, the school system has been around for 200 years. It still works the same principles on which it was founded. There've been profit schools forever, but why do we think that learning how to look at maps in geography is like useful? Why do we think learning about cells in biology is useful? It's just a curriculum. Why is that useful? Maybe gardening is useful. Maybe growing your own food is useful. Maybe critical thinking is useful. There's no profit motive needed for that. I just don't know if the schooling system in general is optimal.
The biggest question is, if there was no profit motive, what would be the alternative? And because that's often the statement a lot of people go, look, capitalism not perfect, but it's the best of a whole bunch
of bad systems. It is the best of the worst. Well, you got the community schools, right? People just, there has to be some sort of funding of sorts. But if the outcome is based on student well-being as opposed to profit, you can have an NGO, right? An NGO school where the community kicks in and donates and do whatever they need to do. Mm. And there's like a broad consensus of what they want to teach the children, anything from gardening to like astrophysics. Cool.
Yeah. I don't see why that wouldn't happen in a for-profit school.
No, I know. It could happen. Yeah. But is profit the best way to educate
people? I think curriculum muddies the water a bit in the sense that curriculum is driven by regulation. The government has a set of subjects that I assume it's the government or the bodies, at least, you know, something like GDE, IEB, etc. Have you know, every student must do a language or two languages, I think, one first and one second, at least, I think, is the ruling. You have to do a maths, or if you don't do a maths, you must do a math substitute, you know, those kinds of rules.
But let's just go back to the question at hand. Yeah. Another reason why I'm not libertarian is because I don't think
that question.
Yes, that one. I don't think that being ideologically pure is very helpful at the best of times. I think humans are messy.
Yeah, very messy. I agree with ideological
purity. And life
purity
is messy. And I don't think being ideologically pure on every single thing is helpful at all. If Herma Mashaba is bringing, you know, is not using labor brokers, it is he's paying security guards himself because it's cheaper and it lessens corruption, cool. A libertarian will be like, that's atrocious.
Well, those of you friends with us, Martin and I had a go with each other recently. But the thing I love with my friends who are firmly on the right is that we can have a go at each other and we're still mates.
And this is a Facebook group, by the way. So you must join it to get involved, because we get quite heated. But it's always like quite respectful.
So, you know, for example, Herma Mashaba, you talk about, and he's done some things. You know, this is a guy who was running the Free Market Foundation at one point. He's very much a capitalist. He's self-stated capitalist crusader. He claims to be a libertarian. And he's done things which, if you are a down-the-line libertarian, you cannot possibly support.
Yeah, you'll be horrified. And Martin, for example, is horrified.
Yeah, Martin is horrified.
Yeah.
I make the argument that there has to be some pragmatism, which is what you're saying about the world being messy.
Absolutely.
And I think, here's the thing, I think you can hold a very strict view of the world as the way you see it. You can say, I am libertarian. You can say, I am a classical liberal. You can say, I am a socialist. But then you have to go, okay, I have these very strict criteria of how the world's going to work. Right now, this second, does the world work like that? And the chances are the answer is going to be no. And if you try and make it work like that, or just look at every example according to your own endpoint, you're going to get very frustrated. And I think that the point is, and it's what I've always asked about a lot of our guests, how do we de-escalate government? Because if you don't want the government, then I don't believe we go from a point, unless we have some sort of nuclear holocaust, I don't believe we ever go from a point of, the government and then no government. We go from a point of government and then hopefully smaller, until in your example, we would get to nothing.
Sure.
And in my example, we would get to controls, only the major stuff that seriously I have no interest in.
Yeah.
And the public sector, I personally wouldn't trust them with.
Sure.
So you know, that's I think you've got to be quite reasonable in that.
And but
lots of people disagree.
Yeah, that's fine. But it's also, I mean, something I learned listening to a podcast the other day, Saudi Arabia, it's a, what do you call it?
Theocracy,
right? And a Muslim chap was talking about it. He says, if you think the royal family is strident, wait till you meet like the actual population. The royal family of Saudi Arabia, who control the country, are actually far more so-called progressive than the population itself.
Well, probably because the royal family have all been educated at Oxford.
Right. But here's the thing. As a libertarian, you'd be like, no, you need like, you know, utmost freedom for anything. But if you give utmost freedom to people who don't want it,
or if you give utmost freedom to people who believe themselves, they aren't being forced, they believe that they can beat their wives. That's what they personally, individually believe.
Yes.
So you give utmost freedom to that person. I mean, look, in Saudi Arabia, you're allowed to do it, right?
Sure.
But if you do that in another country, let's say Belgium, Saudi Arabian moves to Belgium, and now you say, well, we're going to give you complete freedom to do as you please, he will beat his wife. So there's that as well. His freedom may not be
Sure. And the problem with freedom, and the problem with freedom is that we accept things that are anti-freedom in the name of freedom. So we'll accept a lot of people who have shared different culture from us or things like that. As people who love freedom, we accept them into our communities or things like that. But they use the freedom we give them to...
Well, this was on one of your recent studies. I mean, this is where the right eats itself, okay? So the right argues for as much freedom as possible. But as much freedom as possible results in things like everyday feminism having a website and spewing utter shit. Because we believe they should be free to spew that shit.
Yeah.
But the result of that is that 30 years of that type of freedom has led to them infiltrating every single university pretty much in the Western world and now slowly destroying academia.
Right.
So there is, and I don't know what the answer is, but there is...
Well, less government funding, for one, but yes. But yes, I mean, I think people should be free, but I think it's not possible in a nation state to be free in the way that is the most beneficial. So you should, if you have communities across the world without nation states, if you arrive in a community, if I go to Soweto tomorrow, I'm not going to wear an old South African flag, right?
No.
On my pocket, on my person, because I know it's deeply offensive.
Although, let me just tell you, I would bet that if you did do that, you'd probably, I mean, some people would probably say things to you and you would not be liked, but I think you'd be fine. Whereas if you walked through Sea Point, you'd be in trouble.
No, but here's the key thing though. If I do wear that flag, I want people to tell me that I'm an arsehole and a moron, because the cultural and ethical mores of the community are against that flag.
Yes.
And I'm very happy to assuage their sensibilities and not wear that flag. So it lessens my freedom.
Mm.
But the community demands this normative standard from me.
The big thing about freedom is that freedom doesn't come without consequence.
Sure.
So,
I personally I think we have given no consequences
to some things.
To a lot of freedom, yes.
All right. Let's get on to another point, which you often talk about trolling. There was a question asked around trolling.
Is it beneficial to troll?
Yeah. Or Mark asked the question. Right. Do you think that trolling people means the message gets lost or amplifies the message? Does it allow you to transcend your own echo chamber, or does it confine you to it?
I think it will confine you. It depends how you do it. Like, I have actually unfollowed Milo Yiannopoulos, Lauren Southern, the rebel media chaps, because they are creating their own echo chamber. You have Lauren Southern going in the Mediterranean trying to stop immigrant ships from reaching Italy or something.
Hmm.
I mean, that's horrific. That's to me, it's a diabolical act, because in her mind she's so anti-immigrant, without any conception of who those people are, where they come from, what their intentions are. They could be Syrian refugees, you know. I see that as trolling, and it put me off completely, these people.
Yeah.
So I think we troll, I'm not saying it's an art, but we troll when necessary. But whenever we do troll, we're quite sincere in what we say when we troll. We don't just troll for the sake of it.
Isn't there a thing about punching up as well, in a way? You're not really punching up if you're kind of trying to stop a few women in a boat getting to Italy.
Right, but we like a plucky little podcast taking on the Mail and Guardian, for example.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I'll troll them with pleasure. Yeah.
So I think there is something to that. Look, I think you need to be careful as well, because, you know, if you've unfollowed all those people, you could also create your own echo chamber in terms of not getting exposed to them to some extent. I mean, there are some people I think I still follow Lauren. I've never followed Milo, actually. Someone that I stopped following was Stefan Molyneux.
Because
Stefan, who actually does often have some great points to make, and actually the last 2 weeks back, when you listen to this Crowder show, he was on there. Made some excellent points, some superb points that I fully agreed with. But he a while back, I was listening to something of his in which he started talking about intelligence differences in race groups, which was complete bigoted bullshit. And he was using data which I know is false, or falsified in the way that they got to it.
And even that, I mean, Sam Harris had Charles Murray on about of the bell curve fame. Yeah. Even if that is true, there's like a 5% difference between races in IQ points, or whatever the case might be, is that actually helpful at all in any way? I don't mind the research, but the consequences flowing from that are always nefarious. Like, is it useful at all?
Yeah, look, we need to be careful, because I think you need to be careful not to try say, well, it's not useful, so don't do it.
No, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying, is it necessary to know?
Yeah, but look, I mean,
as individuals,
Charles Murray, and that's an important podcast to listen to, actually. One of Sam's gone off the deep end as well on the other side. But of his recent podcasts, that's certainly one to listen to. There are a number of caveats which Charles Murray makes in terms of his book. And if you've read the book, the controversy comes from basically one chapter in the book of what is otherwise
it's two sentences.
A very reasonable, well thought out, well approached book in which, if you listen to the Sam podcast, the Harris podcast, he goes over how many years they sort of spent getting to the end of that book. Anyway, look, I think trolling can be useful. I think you have to be clever about how you do it, thoughtful about how you do it.
And know that you're doing it.
And also, you know, some stuff gets called trolling that isn't trolling. I mean, the truth is all these words are getting stolen. Snowflake is one that drives me mad, right? Because snowflake really means... Trigglypuff is a snowflake.
Yes.
Okay, you're sitting at a lecture, nothing's been said to you, nothing's happened, and you just start banging on the table, throwing your head back and forth, going,
get this hate speech out of this campus, very loudly.
Yeah, you know, that is a snowflake. When you find something that you don't like and you have some justified reason that you can explain reasonably.
If you argue against a position, you're not a snowflake.
That's not a snowflake.
Yeah.
So... You know, I think the problem is these words on both sides get hijacked. I mean, the left has now hijacked snowflake. So every time, you know, Donald Trump does something, for example, and the people go, oh, he's such a snowflake or something, the left now calls him a snowflake, and the right goes, oh, he's not a snowflake. Oh, is that so, snowflake?
I mean, it's really pathetic.
It's completely pathetic, and just be like a fucking reasonable human. What else?
Right. So, second last question. Saral asks, do you believe in global warming? It sounded like you guys were sitting on the fence with Dr. Moore, Patrick Moore, that podcast. I think the climate is changing. I'm not a scientist, but I know that, like, what percentage of the predictions turn out to be false? I think, like, all of them. Turn out to be false.
The further you go beyond 10 years, basically, they all turn to shit.
So I think the climate is changing. There's a lot of consensus, which is fine, but it doesn't mean it's true. So I know I have no impact whatsoever on the ozone or CO2 emissions. I drive one car. I live in one house. I don't put on my heater and aircon at the same time. So to me, I don't really care, if I'm really honest.
So, all right.
And I don't trust the state to fix it because they're the biggest fucking polluters in the world.
Yeah.
They cause the problem if the problem exists.
All right. So my personal belief on it is there climate change? Is there, so there's not, there's, there is and there isn't global warming. Okay. And that's why they had to dump the term. So that's the first part that you need to realize. There's a lot of disingenuous incentive happening. It's a politicized subject. So unfortunately, it's not just scientific anymore. It's definitely politicized. Is the climate changing? Almost definitely. But if you listen to that podcast we had with Dr. Moore, it's spent the last 4 billion years changing. Okay, it will change with or without us. The real question isn't whether, and this is the big argue, the problem is that the argument is still being had. One side says, no, there's no such thing as climate change. One side says climate change is going to kill us all. And that's where the debate is being had. I don't care to have that debate. I think that climate change is happening. What I really care about is, how bad is the problem? Where is it going to be a problem and where is it going to be beneficial? Because any change in the climate globally in some places will be helpful and in other places will be unhelpful. I don't buy the it's going to kill us all argument. And I also believe in humanity. I think that every time humans are faced with a major problem, we overcome it. It's happened again and again in disease. It's happened. Ebola is the most recent example, guys.
Yeah.
We had Ebola. It was an unsolvable problem. Yes, it was because a whole bunch of Americans got sick, but it's beside the point. The point is we had a disease that for 40 years, we didn't know what to do with, no vaccine. Now we basically have a vaccine.
Same with malaria now. We're starting to get a vaccine. Or there's one coming out very soon. So humans are
creatures of necessity.
Yeah.
The real questions we need to ask are questions like, okay, we're making giant agreements in which governments are paying trillions of dollars. And by governments, I mean you. You are paying trillions of dollars to fix a problem we don't actually know whether we can fix. And we don't know if it's worth fixing.
Yeah.
So if I told you
that, if it's a problem.
That I can save you 5,000 rand a month, you can keep your 5,000 rand a month. Every family in the country can have that extra cash, but we're going to lose the front end of Cape Town and Durban. You need to make that decision about whether you think that's a big enough problem or not.
Yeah.
And so these are the real discussions we need to be having. I think that the fact that the issues become politicized and there's so much money going into it is of major concern.
Yeah, it feels like a cottage industry.
Mm.
So last question.
Yeah.
Russell asks, is the personal toll of engaging in frontline idea wars, have we received any terrible abuse or credible death threats as yet? So here's a problem that I face. We receive no hate mail.
That's not entirely true.
Well, except for two things we've done. But in general, every week, we only get NUC support. We got hate mail for the tip for the waitress last year.
Yeah, lots. And that was the only time we got sort of proper threats.
Yeah, and we doubled down and told everyone to go get fucked. And then since then, the Shelley Garland thing got us a bit of hate as well.
Yeah.
But not to the same extent at all.
So, yeah?
So, personally, I actually enjoy fighting with people, to be honest.
Yeah, I think online. It's if you're a confrontational, non-confrontational person. I have to be honest, some of it gets a bit cumbersome or tiresome.
Yes.
In the sense that, for example, I've got sort of haters on Twitter who have been going at it for 5 years. And they have, and if you've been following me on Twitter since I started, you'll know that for the first 3 or 4 years, I literally tweeted jokes. And I tweeted like 8 jokes a day, the puns and you know, nothing. That's what Twitter used to be, actually. It used to just basically be a joke generator. And a lot of my jokes were about Caster Semenya. I don't regret those jokes because they were funny, in my opinion, at the time. And you might not like them and you might find them crude, and that's fine. That's your opinion. And these particular people love to like throw screenshots at me from 2012 and 2011.
Oh yeah, I love that too. They can't find any of me because I don't make jokes about people.
Yeah, so, you know, and I've made some jokes about Serena Williams. I also made jokes about Tiger Woods for what it's worth.
Do you make jokes about anyone?
Yeah, well, but
they come in and leave out the ones you make about men.
That's the point. There's some of that that goes on in terms of the same people popping up. I've got to be honest, a lot of them have been muted, and I don't really see their stuff anymore. No, but I mean,
that's trolling back and forth. That's sort of expected. But for credible threats, no.
No. Over the years, there have been a couple here and there. There was once, long before the podcast, I pissed someone off. I can't remember what it was that I was doing, and they doxed me, essentially.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I found my address and made a threat of sorts. But yeah, come at us. It really doesn't bother us. We're going to carry on doing what we do. And meh.
Yeah. And yeah, well, that's the questions for this month. I don't know how often we'll do these because we've got a hell of a lot of interesting guests.
Did we get to everyone? Oh, we didn't get to everyone. I'm sorry to De Villiers. We didn't get to Borders. So let's we'll save it for next time.
Yeah,
save it
we for will. Next time. We will. And as for the question why Wit has 4 times more followers than I do.
Did someone ask that question?
Yeah. And it's only one reason, because like Trevor Noah retweeted you like 5 times over the course of 4 years, and that's it. And you were on way earlier than I was.
It's also because of how Twitter now works and how it used to work. So in the early days, people used to follow you quite a bit, if you got retweets, and now people are pretty skeptical with their follows. So growth is slow on Twitter.
But I noticed that I've got only 4,800 followers, but if I look at the reach I get, like I get like over a million impressions a month.
I've never looked at my impressions.
Go look at it. Become alt-right, bro. You need to screenshot it and say mainstream media only gets like 500,000
check
reach.
This, I beat Cernovich. Right, so that's the Renegade Report for this week. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you've been enjoying the shows. Please join the group, then you can be involved in question time like this.
Yes, please do. So just look for it. For some reason, I can't link it on Twitter, but I will. But just look for Renegade Report group, and you just send, you click the link, and we will approve you if you don't have a weird Thai name.
Yeah, it's all those ladyboys. That's where to find us on Facebook. There's also a page which you can like, and on Twitter at Renegade_Report. It's Jonathan and Ramon. Thanks so much for listening. Cheers. Goodbye. CliffCentral.com.